It's Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Ryan Thomas and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, it wasn't hacked. Despite what you might have heard or read in some places, we're going to talk about what happened with that image that showed up online that looked like the Gentry Middle School webpage. And what situations like this could tell us about efforts to misinform. Creating workplace cultures that recognize that we are more than our work. We're going to talk about the ways news organizations are looking at employees' needs through different phases of life. And it's time for the video game industry to face the music. Stick with us to the end of the show and you'll see what I mean. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but I wanted to start by asking Ernest and Ryan about what's been going on for the past 10 days or so here in town after a sermon delivered at The Crossing by Pastor Keith Simon. In it, he offered an interpretation of a verse in the book of Genesis and the creation of man and woman. The sermon was about 40 minutes long, and it was divisive, calling transgender people broken. The Crossing has a very large presence in our community, and it is often in the news. A few weeks ago, it received a lot of attention for a fundraising effort that wiped out hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical debt. And it's one of the primary sponsors of the True False Film Festival and Ragtag Film Society, or at least it was. Here's True False co-founder David Wilson.
We lose something as a community if we don't extend people some grace to work through those things. That said, there's no space for hurt, there's no space for harm done to vulnerable populations and to our trans community.
So the Ragtag Film Society choosing last Friday to sever that relationship. This is one of those issues that brings up a lot of layers for us to unpack here. And it's one that has also trickled down into the ways that the news was reported as events unfolded during the course of the week. The Center Project, which is an LGBTQ support and advocacy group here in town, starting a petition calling on True False and Ragtag to cut those ties, pointing out that it was not in alignment, that sermon was not in alignment with a lot of the values that Ragtag and True False said that it espouses. Ironically, though, that was one of the things that The Crossing and Ragtag had said had always made that partnership so beneficial, the opportunity to open up conversations between people that may have had diverging viewpoints.
I think that was the point that both the representatives of Ragtag and the representative at The Crossing said was that, look, you know, we understood going into our agreement that we were at odds in terms of how we looked at certain things in the world. And that was okay because we could come together and at least have conversations and be able to have dialogue and support each other in certain ways. And what I'm seeing very little of in what's happening, not only in the dialogue, but also in the coverage, is a really true understanding of what are the principles at The Crossing. What do they say in their faith statements? And how do those faith statements, how are they articulated when it comes to the relationships that they have with other groups outside of the church?
I agree with that. I think in general terms, I saw this as the public sphere working the way it should, right? So you have members of a community, stakeholders, sort of feeling like an organization that they support is not living true to their values, to the values that it is supposed to represent, putting pressure on that organization. The organization thoughtfully deliberates and comes up with a response. I mean, that I think is that sort of democracy in action in a way. I thought that the response from Ragtag was thoughtful. It was considered. It talked about how they had this goal of talking across difference and how they valued that. But ultimately, this was a divergence of values. And so I thought it was a quite reasonable response.
There are some other layers that are involved here. We often talk about limitations of freedom of speech and the First Amendment. It's one of the things that has become cornerstone of this program. But that freedom of religion is also part of that First Amendment that this program does hold so dear. How does this relate or kind of come into that idea of freedom of the press as well, and where and how that all gets covered, and striking that balance of each of those competing needs or interests of that one part or aspect of what this country is even based on?
Well, I mean, I think part of the issue, and this is something that journalism has struggled with for such a long time, mm-hmm. is actually covering religion. Mm-hmm. And we cover religion as an institution when, in fact, the way in which we probably should be covering it is looking at the individuals who make up a part of that, who make up the religion itself, and how do they see their lives within that religion, because that's more than the institution. So, and even if you look at what's happening right now in terms of the Crossing and its relationship, not only with its members, but with outside groups, a lot of this is individual based, and the stories need to be about the individuals involved, and sometimes move away from this institution is backing away from this institution.
So if you were to be in the position to, you know, dial up the Wayback Machine and report this out differently, who are, if you were to provide sketches of some of those people who we needed to be seeing the reporting about, who would be some of those people or those stories that you would want to see told that weren't?
Well, I think the individuals, the leaders, okay. Yes, their stories should be there, and their stories are
there.
The leaders of both Ragtag, otherwise Sager Broadus Gallery, okay. The Crossing itself. All those leaders, they should be in the story, and they are in the story. What I think is missing is, what about the individual church members? How do they feel about it? What about members of the church who have left because they've sort of seen this and experienced it going back even further than this particular episode? Those are the stories that I think had that been part of the coverage, and it could be part of the future coverage, mm-hmm. then you will get a more holistic idea of what's going on there.
I agree with that. And I think with regards to the First Amendment aspect of it, another aspect of the First Amendment is freedom of association, mm-hmm. right? And so I see this less as a legal matter, but as an ethical matter, where a community and different groups are entitled to hold the views that they hold. We could agree that that's a good thing. But at the same time, organizations can decide to part ways if they choose that they are no longer in alignment. And that's the marketplace of ideas in action.
Well, and one of the things too that we are often having to correct or clarify about freedom of speech and what that means, that doesn't necessarily mean freedom from consequences.
Right. Right.
And our First Amendment right to freedom of speech is the government can't mm-hmm. limit our speech. That's right. Not to say that a private organization or a nonprofit can't say that's not in alignment with who we are, what we are.
Absolutely.
Go ahead and make those decisions.
I mean, private entities are free to do what they wish. It's not a First Amendment issue. Where that becomes a little bit more complex is where you have public entities like the university mm-hmm. or departments within the university getting involved in this discussion.
Which happened too and got a little bit messy at yeah. some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it did. I mean, when the theater department came out and basically in support of Ragtag and called for them to sever ties with the Crossing, they didn't follow the rules of the university and had to pull some of those things back. And I think that goes to basically what Ryan is talking about. Now you're in that murky area where mm-hmm. you start having to deal with, you know, freedom of speech issues as it relates to governmental entities.
Mm-hmm. As a state university.
As a state mm-hmm. university, absolutely. Now, individuals within that, they have the right to do and say whatever they want, but acting in the name of the university, in the name of the government entity, now is where you're starting to tread on some very shaky ground. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there was another somewhat media-related story that ended up being part of the local news cycle for a few days last week. It was a doctored image which looked like the Gentry Middle School website and showed up on the school's Google review page. It was really a screenshot of the school's homepage that was doctored to have certain words replaced with the N-word. School officials were able to make contact with Google and have the photo removed from its servers, but not before there was a whole lot of misinformation that spread and the belief that was held that the website had been hacked as opposed to an image that had been posted that was a fake. I had been asked to go on KMIZ last week, and I did, to kind of explain how this could technically happen. The idea of someone taking a screenshot using a program like Photoshop and entering enough metadata, the alternative text that a search engine like Google searches to actually index images. And if you use the right ones and match search terms well enough, somebody types in Gentry Middle School and it's going to look like that's what's up there. One of the things that really scared me, though, about this whole thing was how quickly that idea had spread that this was a hack, and how easily people were willing to accept that as complete and total misinformation, because there was no understanding of how easy it would be to doctor the image and to spread it and to create that confusion.
Well, I think, I mean, the wider point that it makes, that it raises for me about media literacy, and we rightly focus on that at the school and university level, but we also need to think about how we make adults media literate as well and more media savvy. And so how you do that, I don't know. What sort of programming or sort of outreach efforts you do, I'm not sure. But certainly we would hope that there would be more media literacy, that they wouldn't take that at face value.
I mean, to me, I think once it got up there and people saw it, they immediately said, okay, wait a minute, this is fake. How did they start going to who put it up there and how did it happen and what did the school district do and what did Google do in order to get this down as quickly as possible? So I think people, you know, sort of looked at it, knew it was a hack, knew it was fake, and then started going down the line to say, okay, we gotta pull this back and we have to deal with that. But I mean, to go back to your point, I don't think people are as concerned about how technically you can do these things and make them appear to be something. They're more concerned about how do we stop this from happening to begin with. And I think that's where people are with this.
I agree. I mean, I think it's entirely legitimate for community members to ask questions of the school district about how this happened. That's a perfectly legitimate question to ask, and maybe the more pressing issue.
Well, the thing, though, is that the school district had no role in this. It wasn't a case of a cyber attack. It wasn't some kind of a vulnerability in their system. It was somebody who literally called it up, took a screenshot, doctored the image, and uploaded it to a site not controlled by the school district.
Right. So, no, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, and I agree with you, but that's not the way the public sees it.
Right, and that's the scary
part. And that's the
part.
Literacy part of it that we're talking about, is that the public does not have an understanding of that, and when they immediately see it, they think about who owns that page, and they're going to go to them to get answers to the question. Now, the school district should be there to basically provide that information and say, "Hey, no, this was not us. Someone did the screenshot. They were able to get it up on their Google algorithms, picked it up, and there you go." But you know, that's where people are going to go. They're not going to automatically think, well, oh, wait a minute, somebody took a screenshot of that. That's not where they're going
to
go.
But
well,
I think the issue that is interesting here is just how easy it is to rig Google's algorithm. And that is alarming, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And that somebody just kind of sitting at home, and for all we know, it could have been, you know, some teenage kid that was able to do that. Our next topic, not too likely to make a fellow proud to be an Astro. Last night, the team was hit with exactly the type of attention it didn't want. During the celebration after the Stros clinched the AL pennant Saturday night, assistant general manager Brandon Taubman targeted a group of female reporters with a profane defense of reliever Roberto Osuna. Witnesses told NPR that Taubman appeared to have been triggered by the presence of a female reporter wearing a purple rubber bracelet to heighten awareness about domestic violence. That reporter has tweeted repeatedly at pointed times during games about domestic violence with hotline phone numbers. She would do this often when Osuna would come into a game or make a key play. You see, the Astros traded for him after a 75-game suspension, that he had served after being accused of sexually assaulting the mother of his son a year ago May. She returned to Mexico, and prosecutors dropped the criminal charges against him. He had had a not-so-great game on Saturday, which is what made it really kind of obvious to people who were in the clubhouse and saw this action on the assistant general manager's part that this was intended to target.
Yeah, I mean, the Astros, who, by the way, lost last night in Game 1 of the World Series to the Washington Nationals.
Thank you for watching the rest of the game so I didn't have to.
but they knew that they were going to get heat when they decided to sign him. And they talked about that. And, in fact, they have gone out of their way to support various causes around domestic abuse, and they have been monitoring him along with Major League Baseball. At least from reading all the information, what triggered this was the fact that this reporter repeatedly did the things that you described, and that sort of sent the assistant general manager yeah. over the edge. But you can't do that. I mean, there's no excuse for his actions, and Major League Baseball is now taking a look at it. The Astros have apologized. He's apologized repeatedly for what he did. But now what you have is this heightened awareness of what's going on. He shouldn't have done it, period.
Not only was it wrong of him, but the response of the Astros was wildly inappropriate because it accused the journalists of being irresponsible, of fabricating the story. And since that point, it has been verified by multiple people, mm-hmm. multiple witnesses. And it just sort of seems to me that this is the sort of Donald Trump school of media relations, right? Deny it ever happened and blame the journalists yeah. when in fact it did happen. It's quite shocking, really.
But not surprised.
Not surprised.
and now what you're seeing, I kept seeing yesterday in different areas, and I was busy throughout the day, but a lot of the reporting on this came out last night, probably around the 7 o'clock hour. But I had been seeing in different feeds, like, I didn't really care about this, but all of a sudden, I'm a Nats fan. that all of a sudden, the Astros just kept stepping in it again mm-hmm. and again. And it drew a lot of negative attention at a time when the team would want anything but
right.
and looking for that. So as we move into our next topic, I want to throw some cliches at you. Give credit where credit is due. Cite your sources. Andrew Carnegie said, no man will make a great leader who wants to do it all himself or get all the credit for doing it. So why are some news organizations so against linking to others? Let me put this question into a bit of context for you. It's really just a veiled jab at the New York Times, which has been called out again and again and again for jumping on really big stories broken by other news organizations and followed up on by the Times, but the Times choosing not to link to those original sources. I can understand kind of that concept of not wanting to point out the good work of others, but it made a whole lot more sense in the days of really strong local print editions of newspapers, not 30 years into internet culture, where even our most local newspapers are read locally and around the globe.
Well, I think, you know, linking, to me, it's a win-win, right? Because it's a form of transparency and showing your audience you're working, right? How you got the story. And it's a form of honesty. It's a form of humility in acknowledging others, crediting others for their work. The case against linking seems wafer thin to me. But the New York Times has been accused by other journalists of having this attitude of, well, it's not news unless the New York Times covers it. And so there's a sort of institutional arrogance that has been alleged against the New York Times here.
I mean, I agree with you. And I think part of this is the fact that they've never really had a policy, mm-hmm. which means they've never really had a process by which to do this. And this goes all the way back to, you know, before the internet and mm-hmm. the ability to link stories and that sort of thing. And many of the people who are there now came up through the ranks of the Times when you didn't have this kind of culture mm-hmm. that said, hey, you know, we're going to give the credit to the organizations that broke the story. And so now they're trying to to figure out ways to do that, but it's becoming more, I wouldn't say more and more difficult, but it's almost as if, you know, you're going to have a wave of retirements and a wave of people coming in who understand the culture of linking before you can begin to see it on a on a routine basis.
So ironically enough, this next topic I first read about in the Washington Post, about an op-ed in the New York Times. And sure enough, in the fourth paragraph of the story, a link that takes me to, wait for it, the New York Times. But that's not my point here. My point is the person who wrote that anonymous op-ed in the Times a year ago, the person who said they work for the president but are the resistance, they're writing a book now. It's called The Warning, and it claims to go even further than the op-ed did. The book is still not going to have that person's name there. And I wanted to ask you your thoughts on remaining anonymous at the time that you're doing this in the book form, selling the story too.
When I first read that, what popped up in my mind was, okay, this is a good way to sell a book. You know, because, I mean, really, we talked more about who the anonymous person was than what they were actually saying in that op-ed piece. And now you're just going to double down on that with the book, where you're going to have people trying to figure out who is this anonymous author, as opposed to what is this person actually writing in the book, and is that information credible?
Once they're at the point, though, where they're starting to profit, or someone is starting to profit in a different way, is there an obligation to be more transparent about who that source is at this point?
Well, apparently they say they're going to give some of the profit from this to free press organizations. Mm-hmm. Some is not all, right? So clearly there's some profit left over to be made. You know, my view about this person is that they shouldn't be called a whistleblower, but they should be called a grandstander. So they are, if they believe there is wrongdoing in the White House, they are facilitating that wrongdoing, and then writing op-eds and books that paint themselves as the resistance about it. If they feel there is such wrongdoing in the White House, we have a constitutionally prescribed mechanism for dealing with that. It starts with I and ends with impeachment. And they could come forward and help facilitate that process rather than writing these accounts that tend to be love letters to themselves.
So let's compare this to the 1996 release of Primary Colors, which was also anonymously penned. We now know who that author is. But that was fiction-ish.
Right.
Is that a different situation? The fact that this is a work of nonfiction, does that being anonymous bother you in any way?
I mean, I still think it goes back to what Brian was saying, is that, you know, if you have this information and it is credible information, then you should be one of the people behind closed doors at this very moment up at Capitol Hill giving testimony to the House Impeachment Committee, or to some organization within the government that has the authority to take that information, not necessarily profiting on it and building an anonymous name for yourself. That I just think, this is me personally, somewhere down the line, this person is either they're going to expose themselves or they're going to be exposed, and then that's just going to take the profiting to another level.
Yeah, I think now that there's a book contract that has been signed that increases the number of people who know this person's identity, it's going to be increasingly hard to keep this under wraps. Anonymous. It all takes is one person to open their mouths.
Okay, so we have about 4.5 minutes left in the show today. A couple of quick hits. Ryan, when I was looking for topics, I saw something that piqued my interest, because it's not often that we have our Welsh colleague and friend with us, and that there's media news coming out of Wales. Mm-hmm. So it was an opportunity to ask you to and talk a little bit. There were three weeklies that are going to be shutting down and 24 people losing their jobs. That number may not be shocking to people, but talk about the impact that comes from losing those publications there.
It's an enormous impact, because it means there are whole communities, whole towns now without access to a daily newspaper, whereas there once was a thriving newspaper industry. Many of the same patterns about chain ownership, corporate greed, declining ad revenue, declining circulation. Not just an American issue, but many countries that don't have a tradition of state support of newspapers. This is a quite widespread issue. So sad news for the Welsh newspaper market.
So tell me, just in a couple of seconds, what does the Welsh news audience have to serve it at this point? What will remain?
There are some regional newspapers that are shells of them of their former selves, covering more of a geographical area with fewer people to do it. The Welsh government has provided targeted funding for Welsh language media, but it's very small in scale. So it's a mess, is the short version.
Okay. Something else to call out from the United Kingdom. This is a call out in a good way. Channel 4. Talk about seeing its employees as more than just the work or the mission. It's the first that I know of to create a formalized company-wide menopause policy. As part of it, additional support for employees experiencing symptoms such as hot flashes, anxiety, and fatigue, offering flexible work arrangements and paid leave if they feel unwell due to side effects. There's also a cool, quiet workspace for people who need a temporary change of environment. Maybe it's because I'm getting older, but my first thought was, how cool is this? And at the same time, I'm reading about comparisons of US companies and family leave policies and the gigantic disparities across companies here.
Yeah, no, that's not anything new. I mean, when you go overseas, in particular in Europe and other places in Western Europe, you see this, but when you come here, you're shocked by the fact that we don't have these things. And in the media industry, it's even more paramount. And part of it is the employees themselves, because they push themselves to be on air, on deadline all the time. And that's not conducive to a family-friendly environment.
Yeah, because of the lack of state support in the U.S. relative to European countries, it places much more pressure on individual news organizations then to have their own policies. And as we saw, there was a whole lot of variation amongst those organizations.
Yeah. Okay. And last thing we're going to squeeze in here before we go. Some of our old favorite TV shows we're not finding streaming anywhere. We can't find them on video. How could that be? We've talked about my love for Murphy Brown, The Wonder Years, China Beach, things we've lost and can't figure out why. It's because of all of the licensed music in it. They're just too expensive to bring back. And now we're starting to find that music licensing issue is finding its way into video games, too.
Yeah, I mean, they need to do much more work on this. And I think part of it is actually changing the laws to make it viable. But no one's picked up the mantle to actually do that. So now they're trying to do it individually with contracts and that sort of thing. And it's just been difficult to do.
Yeah, and incredibly expensive, incredibly complex, right? The composition has one set of rights. The recording has a different set of rights. Multiple copyright holders. If they're based internationally, then they're subject to a different set of copyright laws. It is also, well, that's also a mess. Two messes.
Three messes.
Right.
Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today. There's a lot more since we crammed all that in. It's on our links blog that you can find under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll be back with you in about 2.5-3 weeks with another edition of Views of the News.